Thank you. All right, so let's get started. Hello to everybody. It's July, and once again, I want to welcome each of you to our monthly membership call. If anyone here is new, or if you've not called in previously, I want to thank you for joining us, and welcome back to our return callers. I can see a few of you there. Welcome back, Betsy, for one. So I'm glad all of you decided to join us tonight, and this is an important discussion. Now, hello, somebody. Whoever is on the phone, could you please mute?
They don't know how to mute.
Okay, because there's a lot of background noise.
We don't know how to mute.
Okay.
Try *6 and see if that will work if you're on a landline.
Okay. So as you know, our intent on these calls is to create an opening and a space for members and member leaders to communicate, to ask questions, and to share information with other members and member leaders. There is much that we all work on, and we hope to provide for you a forum for you to share your experiences with other members. Many of you may know me. My name is Edwin Gore. I'm the membership coordinator at Amnesty International. I've been involved for nearly 3 decades. I started in a local group and then started working in the office. So this call tonight will highlight our upcoming anti-gun violence campaign and look at some of Amnesty's recent work on the ground. It's a subject that we all know is painful to address, but the recent news shows how timely this work is. So, oddly enough, we had scheduled this topic prior to the events that have occurred in recent weeks, so it has become even more pertinent. Now, tonight we have a diverse group of speakers to cover a diverse set of areas. We will hear from Jamira Burley, who's the manager of gun violence and criminal justice at Amnesty. Ernest Coverson, the senior field organizer for the Midwest. Emily Beck, who's area coordinator in St. Louis. And Oliver Hidalgo-Voleben, who's Midwest representative for National Youth Action Committee, and he's also our current Lattice Christoff Fellow. So we will allow any time for questions you may have, and please feel free to share. We really like that. But I do have the 2 requests for everyone calling in today, and the first one, as I said, is to remember to mute your phone until you're ready to speak. And then when you do speak, would you please state your name? Let us know if you are a member leader and then where you're calling from, okay? So those are the ground rules, and let's just begin. So Jamira, please introduce yourself, and then we'll get started.
Cool. Well, first of all, I just want to thank MMD for organizing this call and for inviting me to participate. Super excited. It's always exciting to hear from members and staff members around, like, what do they think around current campaigns, what are some of the things that they're hearing on their end, and how we can make our communication stronger in order for us all to kind of work towards the same goal. So as mentioned, my name is Jamira Burley, and I'm the manager for gun violence and criminal justice at Amnesty. It encompassed a lot. I also oversee the deadly force work, which kind of falls under both criminal justice and gun violence, and that's where the intersection lies. But prior to Amnesty, I worked as the executive director to the City of Philadelphia's Commission on Youth, where I oversaw all policy as it relates to young people under the age of 25. And so I'm super excited to be here. I've been here for the last 18, 19 months. Feel like I'm going through a pregnancy backwards. And so one of the things is, since I've been here, we launched the Deadly Force Report back in 2015. As a very much a result of what we saw both in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and around the country of police using excessive force against members of the community, and many of times that violence actually resulting to the loss of life. And then we saw a lot of that escalating to gun violence in urban communities and trying to really find, like, the intersection of those two issues, but more importantly, seeing what was the cause and effect of those issues separately as it impacts communities of color and as it impacts individuals in suburban communities. So why we're here tonight is to really talk about gun violence and why Amnesty is taking up this issue, a very large issue, I think many of us would agree, to think about how the human rights framework can really help to move the needle forward and how, one, Amnesty addresses it within our own membership, But two, how we can push the United States and other entities to actually make the reforms necessary to save lives. So why is gun violence one of the most significant human rights crises of our time? So more than 30,000 people are killed every single day due to gun violence. They are our mothers, they are our neighbors, they are our children, they are our students. They're all different types of people. But what we do know by the data that we do have access to is that largely gun violence impacts, while it impacts everyone for different reasons, but when you think about suicide, for instance, it largely impacts white men over the age of 25. When we think about homicides, it largely impacts young black men between the ages of 15 to 25. But mostly gun violence impacts a lot of minorities, Hispanics, African Americans, women and girls. And so that's why one of the reasons why Amnesty is taking up this issue, because it's really pulling at the very fabric of society, and it's honing in on so many other human rights that other people are not able to actually exercise because of gun violence in their communities. So when you think about the right to mobility, to move freely throughout society, the right to education, the right to a job, so all of these things have to be taken into consideration when we think about the harm in which gun violence plays a role in our community. And it's important to note that while you've had pleas from family members, from victims themselves, and actually I should mention, too, while we have 30,000 individuals who are killed due to gun violence, we have more than 100,000 people who are injured and who are injured due to gun violence and firearms every single year. And so while we have pleas from victims, their families, and even the president and members of Congress and state legislators all across the country, active policy has been largely ignored by Congress and local elected officials around the country for a number of reasons. We know that one of our huge opponents in this work is the NRA, the National Rifles Association, which largely does a lot of their focus around the Second Amendment. But what we stand for at Amnesty is just ensuring that we're not trying to say that no one should have access to the Second Amendment, but what we're saying is that the right to life is just as important, if not more important. And the government has a responsibility under international law, in which the U.S. have both signed on and ratified to, that forces them to put precautions in place to ensure that individuals do not have their rights violated and gun violence not used as a tool in which to violate them. And so back to the numbers. As I mentioned, gun violence disproportionately impacts African Americans. They make up over half of all gun violence victims in the United States. And the leading cause of death for ages 1 through 44 for African Americans is gun violence. And women also are disproportionately affected, as those are in abusive relationships are 5 times as likely to be killed by their partner if their abuser owns a gun. And as well as young people between the ages of 15 to 25, young African Americans are disproportionately impacted by gun violence, both in their schools and their communities and many times in their homes. So it begs the question why Amnesty picks this up, because we recognize that it's a human rights violation that isn't being taken seriously enough for Congress to move or local governments to move in a way that can save lives. And so what are the international laws that plays a role in this? Most of which the international community exercises is under international treaties. And so you even have the UN Human Rights Committee express concerns for gun violence in the U.S. and urge the government to take all necessary actions to prevent the continuous number of high rates of gun violence in the country. And so Every entity, not just here in domestically and around the world, are taking notice to why gun violence is such a huge problem here in the U.S., recognizing that we have actually more guns on the streets than we actually have people. And that's huge. So why is this important? So what are we planning to do about this? So I think what Amnesty is honing in to do is to really educate community members, educate our members about, again, how to use the human rights framework as it relates to gun violence. And when we say human rights framework, including the fact that our government, the ones we pay and elect, have an obligation to do something about this, and actually providing solutions for those issues. And I should express, because I'm sure many of you are going to ask this question about a host of different policies or things we agree on. This is new territory for Amnesty. We normally have never talked about gun violence. We did a report about Chicago gun violence about 2 years ago, but for the most part, this is very much new territory. And so as we're building out a report that's actually going to be released early next year, the IS, our International Secretariat, is actually in the process also of releasing or developing their own international report around gun violence. So we're kind of like in a race to the finish line, trying to keep our counterparts abreast of what we're developing, as well as trying to make sure that any information that is developed is cohesive with what is being developed in London and from our partners abroad. So all of those things need to be kept in mind. And before I started, I mean, well, as in the beginning of my statement, I mentioned deadly force. So what are the intersections of deadly force and gun violence? Well, there's something to be said that all violence is actually state violence. And when you think about where most deadly force action happens, meaning police officers using excessive force, and many times illegal excessive force, since we know from our deadly force report that no state, including the District of Columbia, is in line with international standards on the use of force. We recognize that in many of the instances where police officers are using excessive force, they're in the most marginalized communities in our country. So they're in urban communities, they're in poor communities, they're in communities where many times individuals don't have any type of recourse to actually follow up or complain about an officer if they make it out alive. And as we've seen all across the country where police shootings have happened in both Baton Rouge to New York, to all over the place. Like, police shootings are constantly popping up, and it is becoming an everyday occurrence on the news. Well, we also see an underline of gun violence also spurring up. And so there's a lot of intersectionality that we have to look at in thinking about, do police officers in many cases, particularly the over-excessive use of police officers and the over-excessive use of lethal force, actually encourages gun violence from happening in those communities? Does it create a hostile environment that many times the only recourse that those community members have in order to protect themselves is through the use of a gun or a weapon? And so there's a lot of work happening. The deadly force work is a lot more developed than our police, than our gun violence work is. We're working in 5 different states around the country, and you'll actually be able to hear from Ernest right after me talking about some of that work. But we, a lot of the states that we are in is Missouri, California, Maryland, Louisiana, and I think, those five we're in. And we also have second-tier states like in D.C. and Pennsylvania, since those are very close in proximity where Amnesty offices are, and we, there was the capacity to expand in those communities. And we've also done some work in Washington State where we've worked with members of the community to actually pass two pieces of legislation that focus directly on creating an oversight commission that would review all police legislation and review all police techniques and on the use of force, and actually revise them and ensure that they're in line with both constitutional law and international law on use of force. And they use our deadly force as the basis for much of those recommendations that came out of Washington State. So I could talk forever about these two issues, but I'm sure many of you have questions. But before we get to those questions, and I ask that you keep the questions into the end, because someone may answer your question over the course of the next few minutes. And I'm going to pass it over to my colleague, Ernest, who's one of our senior field organizers out in Chicago.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. And thanks for joining in this important conversation. As Jameer said, my name is Ernest Culverson. I'm a senior field organizer for the Midwest. I'm located here in Chicago, Illinois. I wanted to talk about, you know, as we are doing our, as Jameer and the research team is doing the great work to put the report together and come up with our policy and our ask for our gun violence campaign, does not stop us from doing the work. And so many groups, many folks have reached out to their field organizers, to us, to say, hey, what can we do? As this was, officially announced about 2 years ago that we was going to engage into this conversation or into this campaign. And so many groups have been doing some work around the country in regards to gun violence work. And the big piece is to understand that there are organizations already doing this work in many of our communities across the country, some national organizations and then some local grassroots organizations that are doing this work. So the first big piece that I would suggest is that you look and research and find out who's in your community already doing the work. They have the pulse of the community, what's happening in your local area, to figure out what can be done and how we can assist and start having engaging conversation with them in regards to what they're already doing and how Amnesty can support. As we wait for the final report to come out, which as Jameer said, it'll be in January, but it should not negate you from doing some of these things already. So contacting those local organizations, seeing what they are doing, how can you support them? How can you host events with them, do activities to give them that support from Amnesty International and lend that name? I mean, understand and respect if the name of Amnesty carries a lot of weight in communities. And so doing that is the first piece you do. Many groups around the country have started hosting conversations around gun violence to bring that issue out, to talk about it, because I would say we are one of a few, if not the only, that are going or that are framing that the gun violence is a human rights issue. And that intersectionality of places around the world that is also battling this same issue of gun violence. And so holding those conversations either on campuses, in communities that have here in Chicago, our Chicago local group, along with our University of Illinois Chicago local group, college group, has hosted those conversations and brought in partners from Idea Pendleton, one of our Right for Right cases a few years ago that was shot and killed here in Chicago, a young lady that was shot and killed here in Chicago. We've continued to partner with her parents and the foundation that they've created to host a conversation around that, around gun violence that way. So hosting town hall sessions, conversations, educational sessions to start opening up those avenues of communication for various sectors of the community. And to be honest, as Jameer said, this is just not a strand that Amnesty has worked on. And so a lot of people, a lot of our members are new to this work. And so we have to not only educate the community, but educating our members as well to this whole gun violence piece. Also, we have our Chicago local group that have really been pushing this even before Amnesty started this. They've also have a movie out called Making a Killing. It's by Brand New Films. It talks about gun violence. And so they've done a film screening around that, and they also have that available to, we could share that with other groups. If groups want to do this film screening with organizations, we work with the high school chapter to host a film screening at the school and getting young people to start having that dialogue amongst themselves around gun violence. And we're not looking to come up with the final answer to stop all gun violence, but how can folks get involved and start to help curb this gun violence? And there may be local asks that you can look at doing in your own local community. There could be local legislation that groups that you may identify with or find that are asking of their local municipalities to pass around gun control or gun issues in your local municipality that we may or may not be able to sign on to assist and help. And so those are things that, groups can do and start building campaigns locally as we move into national ask and that type of work. But there are actions that's going on already that you can do. So educating most, young people, getting their voice involved in this conversation of gun violence, because as you heard the statistics, especially for black and brown, they are the highest, young people are is the highest number that's affected by this gun violence. And so, doing that. Also, you know, I wanted to, as well, as we're talking about partnering with other organizations, as Jameer was stating in her statistics as well, in regards to women, there are women organizations that's dealing with abuse of women, women abuse, spousal abuse, that type of thing. Partnering with them as well and hosting those conversations with them and bringing them out to, if you're having a town hall, and having them on the panel, and not just the traditional folks on the panel, but using Amnesty as that vehicle to show those intersectionalities of that, that many people do not think of, because typically we see the news and we just hear of either a mass shooting or a shooting in the inner city, but never talk about that this young lady was killed by her spouse or her mate, you know, from a domestic violence situation. And so doing those things. So I'm hoping that kind of sparks some thought in you as you're thinking about how you can do this work, how you can build this work out as we continue to build the campaign here internally as Amnesty, but ways you can already get involved and make that connection with local organizations that's already doing things, bringing other organizations to the table that people typically may not look at or recognize that could work on a gun violence situation, as in, you know, women organizations, other youth organizations, and that type of thing. And then also the health field. We'll be having our HRLI in a couple, in next week. And so we'll be having our panel discussion on that. And one of the speakers there will be talking about, they deal with violence on the health side of violence as well. And so you have many health officials that are dealing and working in this gun violence arena that could also bring a different light and even bring a different audience to your events as you're speaking out about it. And so that just helps to build up your crowd, build up your base, and build the campaign. So when we are doing full-fledged campaign work around it, you already have those connections, those commitments, those partnerships, and we're good. And you're able to roll out what we will need you to roll out that way. And so I'll stop there, and I won't get into the lethal force side. I know Emily is on the phone, our AC from Missouri. I know she's going to deal, you know, with some of that work that they've been able to do in Missouri post the Mike Brown killing. And so I will leave that to him. But that's a lot of the things that's going on right now with gun violence work from groups here in Chicago and then around the country. As you know, we had individuals. Jameer was one that was in Baton Rouge with the shooting that took place there. And so also, you know, involving those type of rapid response situations when we have to deal with the shooting that's taken place by, most recently by police officers. We are involved in those as well, and that's observing the post shooting, where it goes into a lot of the community reaction and protest, you know, observing those, making sure that now the protesters are protected or that their human rights are not being violated as well. So those type of things have been taking place currently around gun violence work. And so from that, Ed, I don't know if you want Oliver or Emily to go on.
Yeah, actually, I would like to just take the break here and open it up to any questions that anyone may have had for Ernest and, you know, his talk about group work or any of the background that Jameera presented.
My name is Maria Clara Ondore, and I'm the co-coordinator for the Capitol Hill CC group. I have a couple of questions for Jameera, please.
Great, thank you.
My first question is, how are we to engage those who don't identify as members of the communities who are most affected by gun violence? Because this is a conversation I have frequently, and I find that people don't care. If it's not happening in my backyard, it's not my problem, it's not my fight, I don't want to get involved. And the other question is, as regards the right to bear arms, how do we engage people who wish to defend their constitutional right, even at the expense of viewing this gun violence issue in a clinical and detached way?
Yeah. So I'll answer your last question first. what I will say is that, again, Amnesty is not saying we want to end the Second Amendment. What we're saying is that, like anything else, like any other privilege in the United States, there are rules and regulations that everyone must follow. And so having the converse, I think most gun owners that you find, many of them do agree with much of the common sense legislation. Like many of them do agree with common sense background checks for all gun purchases. Many of them do agree that that individuals who have guns, if it's lost or stolen, that they should report it. So I think first having a conversation with those individuals about what makes them feel safe, and then also having a conversation around recognizing that what makes them feel safe may not make the larger community feel safe. So what are the middle grounds in which we can help to advocate for and bring them on board to advocate for that will enable us to find some common sense solutions? And I think a lot of times what's been misread in mass media is that any gun control is a step towards removing all guns from communities. So I think if we can debunk that myth and show that the legislation that we're pushing for, the conversations that we're trying to have, is actually not doing that at all. It's just saying that if you do have access to a gun, let's ensure that people who are going to do bad things don't get access, and let's ensure that people who have mental health problems don't get access. And for your first question regarding people who don't think that this is going to impact their communities, I think while both Ernest and I mentioned that gun violence largely impacts communities of color, what you find and you see on TV is that those gun violence has the ability to go into middle America, and it has in many different cases. Every single day, 12 toddlers shoot somebody in their family. Toddlers. We've had more mass shootings since Sandy Hook than we've had in the last decade. So I think showing people different examples of how gun violence has moved, because of the escalation, or because of the lack of reform that Congress has taken, it has started moving further and further into our closed communities that we thought were, exempt from gun violence because they mostly happen in urban communities. So that's one point. And then two, some of the conversations I've tried to have with individuals who don't feel like this directly impacts them is that if we wait until the moment that it directly impacts you, it's going to be too late. I mean, I got into this work very much from a personal point of view because my brother was shot and killed in 2005. But if we started, for many cases, if we started doing the reform that people have been asking for the last decade, we could have saved hundreds if not thousands of lives. So I think having the conversation around what precautions could potentially prevent someone that you love from being killed, and recognizing that if you wait until it directly impacts you, it's going to be, unfortunately, it may be deadly for you to wake up. I'm not sure if that's helpful, but what I will say is that your questions are definitely noted, and we are building talking points around those so you can better be able to answer them.
Thank you. Do I have time for just one more quick question?
I'm okay with that.
Thank you. As regards recent mainstream media condemnation of, for example, the Black Lives Movement as a racist or terrorist organization, despite the fact that it's advocating against, you know, deadly force and gun violence, how do we fight for the, you know, how do we fight against these injustices while also supporting Black Lives Matter and other such organizations, but also without being unfairly labeled as, you know, insurgent or terrorist groups ourselves?
Well, I think what you'll find is, so there's two things. One, I will say is you're going to have people who are going to think Black Lives Matter movement, anyone associated with it, is going to be terrorists. Like that is just been what's fed for them, and they're not going to change their mind. What I will say is that one of the ways in which we can support them is continue to do what many cities have done around the country, like Ernest, is finding out what are the organizations that are doing the work around the movement for Black Lives Matter, and then having conversations around how can we best support them, whether that's through legislative action, whether that's through actual individuals on the ground during their protests, whether that's ensuring that the ask that they have is integrated into our overall ask when we make to Congress or to local legislators. We need more allies, so non-people of color, actually saying that Black lives do matter, and having the conversation around that just because we say Black Lives Matter does not mean that every other race does not matter. It's just ensuring that if we recognize that our most marginalized people in our communities, if they themselves do not feel safe either by police or by in their communities, then what does that say about the safety of for everyone else in our country? So I think finding ways to partner on the local level, because we are doing some national partnerships, and then two, expanding our allyship and ensuring that we create better spokespersons who aren't people of color actually saying Black Lives Matter. Because I think many times it's not the message, it's the person who's delivering the message. So we can have as many diverse voices saying the same message over and over. I think we can hopefully win some new people over. Thank you. Thank you for your great question.
And yeah, I just wanted to chime in as well on that, the first one, how do the folks feel it's not in their community, they don't have to deal with it. I think that's where the intersectionality comes in, because even though they may not be of, you know, Black or brown, but if we talk about, you know, the suicide rate, as Jermaine was talking about, or if we talk about the women killed in the domestic situation, those are, you know, may tap into something that they have experienced or know someone that experienced that. And so those are areas that they may understand. And so once we, you know, if you could bring them in on that part of the conversation, then we can connect them with the bigger picture of gun violence as well. So using other avenues is more than just a Black brown issue, which is a major piece of it or a big piece of it, but there's also other folks that's affected by gun violence that may look like you, that you may have a better connection with. And so gun violence is gun violence, no matter who it affects. At the end of the day, we get the same result of someone is dead because of this gun.
Good, thanks. Do we have another quick question here?
I do. I'm Thalia Elvich, and I wanted to direct mostly to Ernest and give a quick background. I am a healthcare provider. I lived in inner city. I have biracial children. I have been shot by a gun doing domestic abuse. I have had a close friend shot by her husband. Her name was Svetlana Lunch. I had my cousin, Tony, executed, and my son was also shot and nearly killed in a home invasion. And his friend, just like Liz, also murdered in domestic violence. And one of my coworkers was also murdered by her live-in partner. And firsthand experience is, because of all the violence I experienced, I went the opposing way personally and went and got a conceal and carry to protect myself and my family. And when I look at it from a global perspective, Ernest and everybody else, Japan has the lowest murder rate globally. And it is historically so since Hiroshima and Nagasaki had bombs dropped on them. And it's not just the laws of Japan that are much different than America, but it's the culture. And you mentioned a lot of the demographics that have suffered and that I've personally been a part of, Ernest, and others too, in different ways. My thought is, do you believe that as part of AI, we can make a cultural change with conversation to make that effect, not just laws where we're petitioning our Congress people and others?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can change in the conversation we have and how we frame it and the way we present it. I think we could add to the cultural change. I don't think AI will be able to make the total cultural change, no. But I think we can be a part of the cultural change that we need in these communities around the country and around the world, that we could be a part of that piece of that puzzle that gets an ultimate cultural change, as well as the legislative piece of it also. So yes, I think we could, and we, you know, as the membership starts to delve into this, it could easily be incorporated in actions or activities that, that groups do around the country to change that whole culture.
Thank you. That's what I got from you. I just wanted to bounce it again to see if you really feel that conversation is that other tool that we can use. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, thanks. So why don't we move on to Emily?
Hello. I just unmuted. This is Emily. And before I start talking, I want to, I'm in a little bit of a loud space. So if somebody speak up, if I go off, I'm actually in Cleveland for the Republican National Convention, doing some observing work myself, not with our delegation, but I've seen them many times. So they all say hi to this call. So a little bit about my background. My day job, I'm a research administrator, and I do work in grants and contracts and research ethics around protecting humans in research. But my favorite job, I'm an Amnesty member, have been for about 25 years, and I am the Missouri area coordinator. I have been for a little over a year. And I guess what I'd like to talk to you all about is really some examples of what's happened going on the ground in St. Louis, which is about 12 miles southeast of Ferguson, in the past 2 years since the death of Michael Brown. Obviously we're in a constant sort of planning mode for how we're going to remember those who have passed. And so we've got the anniversary coming up on August 9th. But I've been actually doing a lot of reflecting while I'm in another space doing similar work. And I'm here, I'm affiliated with the National Lawyers Guild, and I do a legal observing with them. And as I'm doing sort of the same type of work on the ground, watching what the police are doing, watching what the protesters are doing, are their rights being upheld, are the police stepping in, especially in really volatile situations, as you might imagine, the Republican National Convention could get a little volatile. There's a lot of I've had this sort of opportunity to reflect on what we've been doing for the past couple of years, and as I think about what I would encourage Amnesty groups to do, whether they're local groups, student groups, individuals that may not have a group in your area, wherever you are, I can't emphasize enough what Jamira and Ernest have already mentioned, which is to make sure you're checking in with the organizations in your area that are already doing this work, particularly when we're talking about deadly force, because it does impact people of color more so. It's imperative that we work with organizations. I'm a white woman, and I've learned so much about being a better advocate, ally, accomplice, whatever word you prefer, in these past 2 years, because I've been on the ground on a weekly or daily basis with these organizations and protesters and observers and medics. And it really has been, as hard as it's all been in the past couple of years, it's been incredibly empowering and helpful for our community in St. Louis. We are, as has been reported in the news, but if you lived here, I've lived here almost 37 years, here meaning St. Louis. I see the potential for changing hearts and minds in the community through doing work with people who've been doing this work so much longer than I have jumped into the fray on the heels of what happened in Ferguson, there's already a community in St. Louis asking accountability, and so really inserting yourself in ways that maybe aren't your usual way of inserting yourself or raise views, but the way of participating. There's so much you can do for what's going on to address the issue of deadly force. You can certainly do contacting your legislators, lobbying, which Amnesty has been doing for a long time. But you can also, if you're supportive of protests that are going on in your area, you don't necessarily have to be in the street. You can contact these organizations and volunteer. You know, we have people who come and just hand out water. It's summertime in St. Louis, and we all need water. And I go every time I take a bottle and an extra bottle for somebody else. And every time I drink a lot more than that. So there's that. There's also, there are people that run hotlines here. So my work with the National Lawyers Guild, we're an all-volunteer effort. CNLG is a national organization, and they run jail support. So that when your boss. So if you have those kind of organizations, something like that. On Sunday, our EMC local group, St. Louis, is collaborating with the ACLU to offer a Know Your Rights training. So you could do the town halls where folks talk. And there's also, I think there's a great need for if you know human rights work, or you're willing to sort of brush up on what those articles are, and also, your constitutional rights, think about sponsoring the Know Your Rights session. And if you don't know how to do that, or you're looking for speakers or trainers, there are plenty of people in our community. Anyone is welcome to contact you personally, and I will help you find people all over the country, because I somehow found myself plugged into this huge national thing that I more than to help. But really, the point I want to make is don't perceive what you can and can't do for the deadly force argument as it is a cultural change, whether it's the quest of the gun violence campaign as well. We do it in a million different ways. It's not always the same thing. Certainly, get on the petitions of those pieces of legislation. I'm pleased that in St. Louis, since like around 7 years ago, we have established in the city of St. Louis for the first time a civilian oversight board comprised of members of the community that apply, that are elected to review independently the investigations and issues involving police misconduct. They take place directly. They don't quite have as much power as I would like them to have, but it's definitely a good step to now have this committee that started taking place in May. And for 10 years prior to the city of St. Louis getting this civilian oversight board, it had been in our legislative body.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't want to be rude, but it's very difficult to hear. I wonder if you would speak directly into your microphone, because it's really hard to hear, and I hope I'm not the only one. And sorry about butting in there.
No problem. Is this better? Does it sound better?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, sorry about that. I've been recording a lot, so I think I was, anyway. So I was just saying that, for 10 years prior to the Civilian Review Board being established in St. Louis over the past year and a half, the legislation had gone through our aldermanic board many, many times, and there were many long-term politicians that advocated for it, but it wasn't until people were in the streets and it was clear that there is this demand for accountability, which is, obviously our campaign is deadly force, but it falls under that accountability heading. It really took the push of both working on your lobbying and then also getting out there when there are actions and not sitting at home if you can get up, or if you are not able, finding other ways to work in your own community. We really are, as local groups, as student groups, as member leaders, whoever you are, we really are the face of amnesty in the streets. And as much huge respect as I have for staff and everyone that works, we represent amnesty, and when people talk to us, never before have I been so aware of the fact that the people that are local doing the grassroots work in the streets are we really represent this amazing organization that has a reputation for integrity, and that matters. And so then one last thing I'll say is that when you're doing this work, whether you're joining a protest, supporting it in some way, going to a town hall, do be careful of how you're using the amnesty name. Be sure you check to make sure that the position that Amnesty has taken or not is something that you know before you get into that, because sometimes we collaborate with people and we can find common ground on a single issue, but not necessarily on every issue. And so just be mindful and respectful of Amnesty's name and their name. I know that we can intersect and have been doing that more so over the past couple of years, and I just am really excited to see it continue, and I'd be happy to take any questions that y'all might have. Hello?
Do we have a question there? Okay, so let's move on to Oliver since we want to give him time.
Okay, this is Terry in Oregon. I just wanted to say that somebody said that Amnesty's only intersected in the last couple of years. Amnesty has a long history of intersecting a lot of domestic issues, because I still remember being in an AGM and in the 90s when Amnesty produced a report about police violence in the L.A. Police Department, and the police chief at the time took umbrage with what Amnesty produced. So, you know, Amnesty has a long time, you know, of being involved. So, that, I mean, that's just, as a long-time member, I just wanted to mention that.
No, this is Jamira. I just meant Amnesty work in gun violence is new. Yeah, I'm well familiar with the reports that came out of the L.A. riots. But thank you for reminding us, because I think the work that came out of the L.A. riots, particularly with I remember meeting a major donor who was a staff member at that time who went to the L.A. riots to actually observe. And I think that laid the foundation for how we continue to engage in that work.
Yeah, I mean, I just mentioned it also. Thank you for acknowledging that. And just that we do have a long violent, and this is just another idea, unfortunately, another other time when we have to step forward and join others to try to resolve this human rights violation. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Shannon Rossett from Arizona, NAC for Arizona, and I have a really quick question for you, Emily.
Sure.
It was a little hard to hear, so I just wanted some clarification on something. You had mentioned that we can contact you, was it for if we need somebody in our area for a meeting or a speaker or something like that. Was that something that you were saying that we can contact you on, or was I hearing incorrectly?
Yes. No. Yes, absolutely. Now, I definitely think that there are probably staff resources, and Ernest is probably better if you're – well, you're in Arizona, so you're in the West. But at any rate, I have found myself, as a result of all the work that we've been doing, and I say the past 2 years, just to address the immediately preceding comment, you're absolutely right. I just feel like in the past 2 years I've been doing it on a weekly basis with my body instead of my pen, if that helps. But it's a really, really great thing to point out. Anyway, but yes, so we have the local St. Louis group has really, our approach has been to jump on where we can. We're not a huge group in St. Louis, but we all have a lot of experience. And so, you know, I'm a legal observer. Another one of our members is a medic. And so with those relationships that we have formed over the past couple of years since Ferguson, we've found ourselves plugged into national networks of medics, of legal observers, of civil rights attorneys and things like that. So, yes, while I would encourage you certainly to be in touch with your field organizer about those kind of things, I am absolutely willing to help you find people that might be interested in coming to talk to you in your groups, and I would be more than happy to be in touch with you about that separately.
Great. Thanks, Emily.
No problem.
Thank you, Shannon. Okay, I think we need to move on to Oliver. Oliver, you want to start?
Yeah, thanks for the intro, Ed. And feel free to chime up if you can't hear me, because I know that's sometimes a problem. Just to give people a little bit of an exposition on what I do who aren't so familiar with the fellowship. So I'm the Lattice Kristoff Memorial Fellow. It's a 10-week fellowship in the New York office with the Member Engagement Unit. And so the work that I'm doing after creating a research proposal is around the narrative in which we approach gun violence. And it sort of falls within the upcoming campaign, but particularly about how we change this on a political and cultural level, but also internally within Amnesty. This was initially, I looked at different ways, and this was sort of inspired by some suggestions within the organization about how we address new campaigns and how we effectively convey them to members and how we get people on board, but also how we frame our message holistically. And so the things that I've been working on is what the policy changes in the future will hopefully look like, and then also how we address this culture of using language. So those are the big two. And I'll just start with policy. So I actually was in D.C. last week and had a chance to meet with some internal staff, but also with some offices, congressional offices, and talking about what the policy narrative around this looks like, what realistically will happen, but also on how they're hoping to change this, because I think often gun violence becomes framed around the issue like Second Amendment rights rather than the human rights and safety, and also the international law codes and that Jamira talked about and other folks. And I think that we can change the narrative without knowing the nuances of international law. You can basically focus on like the human rights to safety, and the very basic rights to safety should be looked at first. And I think that that's something that will actually change in the political narrative coming up in this cycle. Obviously, within those meetings, you know, a lot of it's like picking people's brains, but you know, with amnesty status as a 501c3, you have to be careful when you're working with political offices. But within that, I think that for members who are lobbying, it's important to know what's happening on a national level, but also the nuances for laws in your own states. For example, Emily's in Ohio, and I believe that they have open carry laws. So it's what's happening there versus what's happening in New York is very different, and how we address that nationally as an organization and then in state-by-state cases is different. So what I've seen just from toolkits and what's effective in the past, too, of how we talk about it is, one, very, like, sort of factually oriented, but two, engaging people in ways that aren't, you know, I mean, it's like basic psychology stuff, like not I'm right or wrong, but it's rethinking the entire way we approach the situation. You know, at this point, we have all these statistics that are out there with like 30,000 deaths per year. It's more dangerous for young people, for people of color, for women, for children. And so it's including all of these fact sheets that will be brought up in the upcoming campaign, but also looking at it from a cultural perspective. So that's the policy component. From a culturalist perspective, it's looking at sort of like the intersections between all these different issues. So AMC obviously has the history of working on cases of persecuted peoples, and they've also touched on other larger situations where human rights crises will have disparate effects on different populations. And so you can look at it from that perspective as well. As I just mentioned, there are sectors of the population who are directly affected this in different ways than others. But I think that what Jamira said earlier, too, is that this has made its way into sort of middle America. Like there are seven cities where the majority, or five cities with the vast majority of gun violence occurs. But I'm from Iowa originally, and I graduated college, and I moved home for 2 weeks before coming out to New York. And there were two shootings less than a block away from my parents' house where I was living. You know, to see that in a place like Iowa, where relatively, if you look at numbers and statistics, it's a fairly safe place, and there are a lot of shootings, you can see how this has sort of permeated all states in the U.S. And so the idea that it doesn't affect one community and framing it that way is that it really does. If you sit down and look at the numbers, it's just that there's not as much coverage often when it's not a high-profile case, just because unfortunately, this has become so common. So I think when addressing that, talking about how it does affect your community, and, you know, it's smaller numbers, but, you know, it's how we tolerate that. So I think it's the big two issues here are changing the policy narrative and changing actual laws, but also a cultural tolerance of these. And then Amnesty, of course, will have official stances that will be coming out, and official language that will be effective to use. But I think that there are different ways to approach this and be effective when you engage people on it. Another issue that I've seen with this, too, is that like, there are intersections between this and gun violence and over-policing of communities and police killings. There are short-term solutions, like probably adding background checks and assault weapon ban on like a national level and a state level, but also a lot of this stems from lack of access to a lot of resources. So underinvestment in communities, but also in cases of suicides, which account for a huge amount of gun deaths. A lot of those are men, white men over 25, oftentimes veterans. And so you need to invest in mental health facilities because, you know, people can be a danger to themselves and also to others, and then not, and without, you know, treating that properly, that becomes an issue. And so you see how this transpires into a bunch of different, you know, further problems. But, yeah, so I'm trying to approach that in a couple of different ways. At the end of my fellowship, I'm creating a list of recommendations that will include on how we will include recommendations on how to address this campaign, get people sort of on board, and also to include language on how to stay safe when talking about this. You know, obviously a lot of our campaigns that we talk about can be viewed as controversial in a national spotlight, but especially with this, whereas there can often be an immediate danger, it's important to take that into consideration and how you engage people, and how you address it state by state. Yeah, so my work is still definitely in progress, but and I'll be sort of sending out things as I complete it, but I'm certainly open to any questions and any collaboration, that people are interested in doing. I've been working again with political offices, with internal staff, and also with some local groups, on how this affects them differently. So yeah, I'll open that to questions.
Any questions for Oliver? Any questions for Emily or Jamira or Ernest?
Yeah, this is Terry in Oregon again.
Hey, Terry.
What about outside communities? Hi, Oliver. We met. Yeah. I expect to see you next month. I hear the date's August 26th or something like that. You'll be at our potluck at Group 48 to meet Jane Christoph. And gang. Anyway, what I was wondering about is what type of outreach are you doing to the non-amnesty groups in this issue? Because I know that other groups of faith are interested in this, so I was just wondering how are you going to outreach other coalitions, your partners?
Well, so this is, go ahead. I don't know who you were directing it to, but go ahead if you want to keep going.
I can do the national list, and I'll turn it back to you, Emily. There's about five different national coalitions that I meet with regularly that have all of the usual suspects. So you have, like, Every Town to Prevent Gun Violence. You have Mayors Against Gun Violence. I'm sorry? Yeah, you have Mayors Against Illegal Guns. You have literally hundreds of organizations. And then also we got a grant last year to basically give smaller sub-grants to partnering organizations to help us structure how we develop our gun violence campaign. And so they're national organizations. They're, for instance, their Million Hoodies campaign, which is started after the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. They're the Justice League, which is based in New York, is the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, which is based in San Francisco. You have the National Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. And so all of these organizations have agreed to work with us to develop our gun violence strategy. But I sit on a least unnecessarily amount of coalition meetings who are well aware of the work we're developing and are excited that Amnesty is getting kind of in the space more with gun violence.
So you're saying that if I got your action circular, I would be able to see have the groups that I might contact to see if who they're working with also. The reason I ask is I'm part of other coalitions and people and groups and social justice groups with faith groups that I hope to introduce Amnesty's issues, you know, with them and hope to have a way to say, okay, you know, if they're not involved with another coalition to get them involved in the issue. So I'll go to that action circular, I guess.
So I support everything that Jamira is saying. I would also say I'm not sure what the demographics in terms of population numbers are for your community, but because St. Louis is a larger city and because people came from all over to help us, I have to say it's been fairly easy to just have casual conversations with people representing dozens of organizations here in St. Louis. But at the same time, even before things started getting really active here, one of the things that I suggest, St. Louis is actually not a huge town. You know, we know the folks from the ACLU. We know folks from, you know, a bunch of different other groups. There's an organization for Black Struggle here that's a local grassroots group. I think showing up at their events, showing up at their meetings when you're welcome, I think you going to them is really, really helpful, because what ends up happening over time is that then if your group or a group of, you know, I don't know what the status of your groups there in Oregon are, but like down the road, if your group then wants to do a town hall on a similar issue, then they bring their members there, and you're building coalition by connecting organizations, but with that, I think there's an inertia of sorts that means other people who aren't really connected to either organization will also show up. So I hope that's helpful, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm already familiar with, like, the first thing you do is show up at their groups. And,
exactly.
We've also been involved, right now I'm involved with different groups. We have the ACLU here, and I'm part of them. But then also, the Unitarians. I know they're very active, and I was just wondering if, in your campaign, if there is specific outreach. But it sounds as though you're working with different coalitions, and so that does answer my question. And I'm very familiar with the first thing you do is show up at their events, and the second thing you do is shut up.
Yeah. Well, but then also too, that's true.
About talking a lot.
Yeah.
When they really
that's true.
So
that's true. But also too, one last thing, if you're mentioning like churches, if other members of a congregation are interested in these issues, if you have just a small number of people, they could start an amnesty group at their church. There's nothing that says they can't do that, you know. So.
Well, that's as a longtime amnesty, one of my goals is to start
Yay!
A group, of course. So,
yeah, we all do. Thanks so much for your work.
Yeah, okay. I guess there's one thing.
Go ahead.
Or if I could just chime in quickly, there's one thing I'd add to is also knowing you're just like local activist group, which I'm sure you do. But like it varies per city and region of how it's affected and the laws that you hopefully want to change state by state, right? I mean, just the city that I'm originally from is Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And we recently started a task force that's led by the city government to curb gun violence. And that was a combination of local activists, political activists, and faith-based groups and other just people, just concerned citizens, people who are affected by this on a daily basis. And so this is something that I think that this is one of, this will be sort of like a paramount issue for our generation. I've been hanging out with too many youth activists lately. They always use that term. But sort of like of our time, right? Because so many people are affected by this, and I think that it can transcend part of the political spectrum, hopefully. I know I have some family who are pretty conservative, but when it comes to the issue of gun violence, they want to solve it in different ways than I think to do. But I think it's a good chance the coalition build to on other issues and where you can work with people who view the world differently, but who want to basically stop people from being killed. So yeah, that's what I would ask.
Yeah, we just had our, this is Terry again in Portland, that we just had our strategy meeting at the Unitarian Congregation, and, you know, this whole issue is they want to take it on, and I'm encouraging them. I just want to hope I can get the support from Amnesty to do that. Sounds like I will. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks, Terry. Any last comment from anybody? How about making DC? Anyone? Okay, great. So go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. Maria Clara from the Capitol Hill DC group again. So I think one of the strongest messages I've got from attending this call is that we have to tailor, use a psychological approach to tailor. Tailor the message to your specific audience. If I'm speaking to my white husband and his colleagues, I bring up the white male suicide stats. If I'm speaking to mothers, I bring up, you know, toddlers in shooting accidents. And if I'm speaking to women, I can bring up the DV victims issue. Is that am I correct in thinking that's the approach?
I yes and no. So I think yes, that is their approach and how we bring them in, showing them that if we look at urban violence as something that doesn't impact us, then you, what you see is these examples of it impacting middle America. And so recognizing that these two issues are not working in silos, that gun violence actually is all interconnected because they all center around the issue of gun violence. So I don't want to get into the conversation. Like, my biggest fear is that with the gun violence movement is that a lot of it's being separated by people who are directly impacted in the suburban areas and then directly impacted in urban community. And some solutions fit one group of people and some doesn't fit the other. And so I think it's really important for us to recognize that we're looking for solutions that really tackle gun violence on a more cohesive level. But I think you're right, in ways in which we engage them is showing that while you may look at the violence in Chicago as something that doesn't impact you, but how does that violence in Chicago actually bleed into your community? And these are the A and B examples of those.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, very good. So I think we'll bring this to a close. And I say once again, I'd like to acknowledge our wonderful speakers, Jamira Burley, Ernest Coverson, Emily Beck, and Oliver Hidalgo-Voleben. And I thank them all for sharing their expertise with us today. Thanks especially to each of you who called in today. We really appreciate it. And I invite you to join us on the next call, which will be held on Wednesday, August 31st. So keep tuned in, look at your email, and join us again. All right, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Bye.
Mm-hmm.